If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. When one thinks of the pre-Confederation development of what would become Canada, one might think of war, empires, nations, trade, fur, colonization, resistance, and so many other themes and topics that have been enshrined in our understanding of early French and British North America. What's interesting is that hidden in almost every topic related to the pre-Confederation colonial decades in North America is a surprising constant presence, that of alcohol. Alcohol has been at the heart of the settler colonial experience since the first Europeans arrived on the banks of the St. Lawrence River. Alcohol, already central to European personal, economic, and professional relationships, became central to the European colonial project, the slave trade, the fur trade, and came to define much of the lives of those European settlers attempting to forge a life in North America. Of course, alcohol was not without its detractors. Religious leaders, pious settler communities, labor groups, and First Nations all sought in different ways to limit or resist both the temptation and the spread of alcohol in North America. And by the middle of the 19th century, the tide of alcohol had subsided considerably. But the analysis of the causes of excessive drinking, focusing as it did on the inherently disorderly conduct and defective self-control of the, quote, lower orders, as well as the inherent vulnerability of Indigenous peoples, has misled generations of historians. In many ways, alcohol became wrapped up in the struggle for survival between those who had lived here for generations and those who were newly arriving, between nations and empires, between different classes. And alcohol played a role in shaping the future of North America. This is Season 9, Episode 15, Alcohol in Early North America. To help us dive into this complex subject, we've brought in an expert in the field, historian Alan Greer. Alan Greer is a historian and professor at McGill University. Originally trained as a historian of early Canada, over time he expanded the scope of his research and teaching to include colonial North America, the history of Native peoples of the Americas, and the history of the Atlantic world. He is centrally involved in Montreal's French Atlantic History Group. Alan Greer has published extensively on, among other topics, the social history of early French Canada, the Canadian Rebellion of 1837-38, state formation, the early modern Jesuits, religious change and colonization, colonial saints, property, and the history and historiography of New France. His books have won a number of national and international awards. One of these is a book titled Property and Dispossession, Natives, Empires, and Land in Early Modern North America. This was published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. I began our discussion by asking Alan about the early emergence of alcohol in the old world and its eventual arrival in the new world.
Right. So various kinds of beers and wines have been around for thousands of years in the so-called old world, so-called new world as well. It's just a matter of fermenting any organic substance that's got some sugar in it. And you get a kind of low level of alcohol. If it's from fruit, we usually call it wine. If it's from, grains, it's usually called beer. Even in the Americas, there was, plenty of fermented beverages made from, cassava, corn, and so on. This is mostly in the more, tropical and southerly portions of the Americas, not in what's now Canada, but mostly places that where agriculture was practiced. It can be a nourishing as well as a very mildly intoxicating kind of beverage, as we all know. Mm-hmm. So what distillation is about is concentrating the alcohol content. So you start with some version of a wine or a beer. You kind of boil it. You take advantage of the fact that alcohol vaporizes at a lower temperature than water. And you heat it up, you get the vapor and you direct it into a tube where you cool it, usually by, metal surrounded by water to cool it. And the alcohol distills out and you capture that and you can double distill it and really get, quite a high level of alcohol. So that's something that emerges in, I guess, what we'd call the Middle Ages, probably in the Middle East to start with, gets into Europe. For a long time, it's more like a medicine than a beverage.
Right.
So apothecaries, pharmacists will have a little still on their bench. And they'll give it to people. And it was alcohol was considered a kind of all-purpose wonder drug that made you healthier in general. It also was appreciated for kind of they thought it sort of warmed the body. And that notion of alcohol as having kind of medicinal qualities and a kind of warming potential that continued into quite modern times, even though I don't think it does actually warm you up,
the science might be out on that.
and doesn't help your health, but it was, as I say, it was initially a kind of medicine taken in small quantities, and it's only kind of in the early modern period, around 16th century, getting into the early 17th century, that it starts becoming a kind of industrially produced product. Mm-hmm. That happens to be when North America is being colonized, and that's probably not an accidental coincidence. We're talking about something initially medicinal that becomes a kind of drink for mass consumption,
right?
At a time when Europe is reaching out commercially to the Americas and other parts of the world, and alcohol is one of the things they have for sale,
right?
Internally for their internal market and for the rest of the world.
So spirits go from this medicinal sort of beverage to a product, a commercial product. And then they begin to arrive in both French and later British North America, or what becomes Canada. So maybe take us back to when and why do distilled spirits begin arriving in what would become later Canada?
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I make the point that The first explorers coming here did not have alcohol, most likely. So on board, say, Jacques Cartier's ship, there would be barrels of wine because that was, you didn't want to just drink water that had been sitting around on board ship for a long time. You mixed it with wine. It was also kind of considered a source of nourishment. So there was always wine. But it's only as we get into the 17th century that you get distilled alcohol making its appearance. And initially, the wine, there's some interesting stories about, the early French explorers offering wine to
Yeah,
indigenous people.
right.
And people like the Mi'kmaq said, "That's disgusting. It looks like you're drinking blood."
I know.
And they were put off, and eventually they were persuaded to give it a try, and eventually, so it's so the wine comes to be supplemented eventually by distilled alcohol, and because they're coming from France, it's grape based brandy,
Okay.
almost entirely, and that's kind of grape based French brandy is considered the alcohol of choice.
Right.
It's considered, good taste, refined quality, and that kind of stuff. And everything else is kind of rot gut. So, at the same time that's emerging, you've got sort of, peasant backyard stills making grain-based alcohol in places like the Scottish Highlands,
Right.
Ireland, Eastern Europe, where they call it whiskey or vodka or something. And that's just like, ordinary poor people making an intoxicating beverage for their own local use.
Right.
But brandy is the standard, standard of quality for most of the early modern period.
And brandy gets or becomes important in some of the earlier economic transactions between Europeans and indigenous people.
Yeah, so it's very important in the early fur trade, and it causes a lot of controversy in New
Right.
France, as many people will be aware. Bishops denounce it because they see it having a destructive effect on indigenous people, producing a lot of violence. So they threaten excommunication on fur traders who trade in brandy, and it's the biggest controversial public issue in New France,
Wow.
period. There's just there's always fights about it, and governors and intendants are told to clamp down on it. The problem is they're usually under the table investing in fur trade ventures. So
Right.
they've got a conflict of interest. Anyway, so a lot of ink is spilled about that. And it's given the impression, a lot of historians think, oh my goodness, alcoholism, particularly among indigenous people, was just rife in New France, and it
Right.
was greater than is a bigger problem than anything else anywhere else. That turns out to be a bit of an optical illusion because it's because the Catholic Church was so worried about it. And also there's a way in which they were kind of using alcohol as an excuse for the failures of their own evangelization. They'd say, if only people didn't bring brandy in here,
Right.
everybody would have converted to Christianity and everybody would be well behaved. So it was a nice all-purpose excuse. And as I say, it gave the false impression of a sort of an exaggerated sense of how prevalent brandy was, because it maybe wasn't quite as big a problem and quite as common as the sources might lead
Lead
you to
us
believe.
to believe.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. I love that part about what you were writing about that aspect of it, that it's sort of like the sources focus so much on it that then we get a skewed view of the issue at hand at the time. However, it is clear
that brandy is a valuable form of commodity exchange, right? Like this is still being used as a, you know, a currency or a trade good that carries quite a lot of value with it into the hinterland of New France. Is that correct in saying?
Well, it's partly correct because the way alcohol is used in the fur trade is it's sometimes just directly traded for furs, but more often it's a kind of sideshow,
Okay.
an inducement, you know? So you offer somebody a drink in order to encourage them to trade their furs for your, you know, guns and pots, or you give them some guns and pots and expect them to bring furs next year, and you give them alcohol to, you know, to celebrate the payoff. So it's partly a commodity, it's partly a sort of commercial lubricant.
Oh, interesting.
Which of course it is in a European
Yeah.
context as well, right? I mean, business people have a drink when they conclude a deal, and so on and so forth. So as I say, it's both a commodity and a lubricant.
Well, that's really interesting. So it's pretty clear then by the time we get, let's say, to mid 17th century, as the colonies of New France are expanding in size, as industry or early industry is, you know, proto industry is starting to develop and, you know, in a rudimentary way, that alcohol has become, specifically spirits have become a fixture of life on the frontier, right?
And in the towns as well, yeah.
And in the towns, okay, and then and but what's interesting is then we you talk about you spend time talking about rum. So rum kind of comes in a little later than brandy, right? So maybe give us a bit of the background of rum and its emergence in this global spirit trade.
So rum is the one alcohol that's one commercial alcohol that is produced in the Americas. It's a colonial product, and it's very much a British colonial product to start with. It's invented in the island of Barbados. It's a byproduct of the sugar plantation, the manufacturing and refining of sugar. You know, you refine sugar from you take raw brown sugar and you make it into white crystal sugar, and in the process, out seeps this black gooey stuff called molasses. And initially they didn't know what to do with it. It was just, you know, it was just garbage. And it looks as if enslaved people probably retrieved that molasses and also the scum they would take off the vats where they refined where they actually made the sugar. Mix it with a bit of water and let it ferment, and they got a kind of a beer or wine from that. And then so the planters observing this thought, there might be some possibilities here. So they bring in distilling equipment from Britain and distillers, and take this, you know, fermented stuff and make it into distilled alcohol. And so this would be like the 1640s, 1650s in Barbados. Then it kind of gets into other West Indian islands, spreads, you know, Jamaica, various places like that are, and much later Cuba, and the French islands. I'm not sure if you want me to go into more detail on this, but there's the story about why the French don't make
Yeah.
rum very much.
Yes,
They
please
can
do
make a
tell.
bit. So the French have, you know, thriving sugar plantation islands as well, but the French government doesn't want this colonial alcohol to compete with their domestic brandy. So they keep it out, and they eventually pass legislation prohibiting the importation. So although like the West Indian planters are allowed to sell rum in places like Canada, it's not a very big market, so they don't have the incentive to really invest in that industry. So
Right.
instead, they tend to sell their molasses and their scum to traders from New England who
Oh,
sell
okay.
it into New England, and they make it into rum.
Right.
So you get a bit of rum from the French West Indies coming into Canada as of like the 1720s, 1730s. But so this is like 100 years of brandy being the only
Right.
available beverage. Eventually, you get a little bit of French rum coming in, but it's heavily taxed. So it's cheaper than brandy, but it's not a lot cheaper. So brand, French brandy still is the dominant product as long as the French rule Canada
Right.
because of these mercantilist kind of restrictions.
In the, let's, the 13 colonies and things like that, would you say that rum is having a much, is m much more vastly consumed in those colonies?
Absolutely,
Okay.
absolutely. So it becomes early America's biggest industry
Oh,
is
okay.
maybe shipbuilding might be competing with it, but it's a huge industry in places like Boston, Newport, Rhode Island, New York, and many other smaller towns. They're making tons and tons, literally millions of gallons of colonial rum.
Wow.
The people, the very rich and refined still prefer French brandy, but for ordinary colonists, as well as indigenous fur trade kind of stuff, it's rum all the way, and it's kind of it's described as like hot, hellish, low quality rot gut, but it's cheap and it's plentiful. And so while New France has got mostly just brandy, New England is just swimming in cheap rum.
Now, what is the triangular trade, and how is rum, how does rum become connected to it?
Well, so there's there one of the places that the New Englanders sell their rum. Well, one of them is Newfoundland, actually. That's the biggest
Oh,
market. It
that's
just
interesting.
kicks things off, Newfoundland fishery. But eventually they start getting involved in the African slave trade. So they'll send shiploads of rum to the Gold Coast of Africa, use it to buy slaves. Ship them to the West Indies, then come back to New England filled with their holds filled with molasses to make more rum.
Right.
So, across the Atlantic and up and down, that's what they mean, I think, by triangular trade.
So molasses going to New England, becoming rum, which goes over to West Africa, in turn traded for slaves, which then get brought back to the Caribbean and the Central America or Central South America there, right? Okay, that's, I mean, that's really fascinating. One of the things that I think really stands out when we talk about slavery and the sugar industry is how horrific and brutal the conditions of working on these sugar plantations were. Would you mind elaborating on how horrific it really was? Because boy, it's shocking when you read those primary sources how truly, damaging it was to those who worked on those plantations.
Well, slavery is always pretty nasty, obviously. But it seems like, the sugar plantations of the West Indies were as bad as it gets. And the plantation owners had a kind of, they had their eye fixed on the bottom line well in advance, like a very modern concern for profit at all costs. And that meant you save money by not feeding your slaves or dressing them adequately. You work them literally to death. The life expectancy was very low. And you, of course, this provokes, is bound to provoke resistance on the part of the enslaved. And you overcome that resistance by pervasive sadistic violence, flogging, torture for those who attempted to revolt or escape. Chopping off limbs, flogging people till they bled, and then rubbing salt and lemon juice into the wounds.
Oh
Just
my.
it boggles the mind when you read some of the accounts of what happened. So it was a particularly vicious, totally exploitive enterprise. And so that's I mean, some people might find it a little shocking to realize the intimate connection, of course, between that industry and some of the extractive industries in Canada that
Right.
made use of the byproducts of this system in the form of rum.
Right, especially in, I think especially after the Seven Years' War, so after Britain kind of conquers what was French North America, it's really difficult to separate rum importation into what becomes Canada from the horrible realities of slavery in the West Indies and elsewhere, is it not? So, I mean, you were talking about a sort of hidden connection between what becomes Canada and a slave trade in the West Indies and elsewhere that perhaps a lot of people are just not aware that that connection ever even existed.
So, so Canada, of course, is a supplier to the West Indian plantations in a small way compared to the Americans, but they're also big consumers of this sugar byproduct, which is rum,
Yeah.
mostly by way of New England
Right. Yeah.
initially before the American Revolution.
One of the interesting aspects of your research is when you discuss something that you titled or you phrased as the first globalization. I'm fascinated by this phrase, and could you explain this to myself and the listeners if you don't mind?
Well, I mean, we're talking about this period of, the early modern period, say 16th to 18th century, when the world is becoming connected commercially and economically, and Europe's at the center of it. They are conquering parts of the Americas and colonizing it, but they're also just sending ships around the globe with whatever products they've got to
Right.
hand to to get their tea from India and their coffee from Brazil and so on and so forth. So we have the movement of people and wealth and commodities on a global basis that, is obviously very much with us today, but is really getting underway at this time. And it's kind of inseparable from the rise of capitalism, from the rise of imperialism and colonization. It's all kind of a package that in its own way connects the distant parts of the globe together. And I think I would say rum is definitely part of that.
Curious Canadian history. We'll be back after the break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's go to 1763. So post-conquest or the conquest, and then in the years following the British conquest, do drinking habits of what would become Canadians or British North Americans, do they change under British rule?
Yes, and now we're talking. The Maritimes are already in the British orbit, and they're all rum is already a big deal. But it's a very sudden change in Quebec, what we'd now call Quebec. It's the war of the British conquest has not even ended. They're still fighting when ships show up in the port of Quebec from New England, loaded with cheap New England rum.
Oh, wow.
Got reports as of 1760, like before Montreal has fallen, where they're saying there's so much rum here because these merchants are basically following the armies and the navies, because that's the big customers, of course. There's so much rum here that it's cheaper than in Boston, where
Wow.
it's manufactured, right? Because there's such an oversupply. So it's clear that that alcohol is suddenly way cheaper because if rum and brandy had been available under the French, but it was heavily taxed
Right.
and that tended to keep the prices up and therefore the consumption somewhat modest. So we find, for example, the ordinary settlers, the habitants of Quebec, mostly, according to most reports, you know, couldn't afford to be big drinkers prior to the conquest. Right after, as of the 1760s, they're talking about everybody getting sloshed, every farmer going into the urban market, coming back half cut. And it's clear from the numbers as well that per capita consumption has, you know, very quickly jumped because, and this rum that comes from New England is not taxed. It's not, there's no import tax on it. Wow. So it's already cheap to start with. It's not taxed. So suddenly it's available. And there's just a lot more drinking on the part of colonists. And it changes a lot of things as far as fur trade and relations with Indigenous people are concerned as well.
Perhaps maybe we could expand on that. Would you expand on how it does affect that fur trade that is still on? You know, we need to stress it's still ongoing. The British sort of inherit the French networks and then now have to, you know, utilize them or exploit them in the way that the British had already been doing, let's say, what would become the United States. So how does that conquest and rum sort of affect the fur trade at that time?
Yeah, well, so the French had always used brandy, again, as a commercial lubricant with dealings with Indigenous people as with dealings with other European merchants. But just the amount is skyrockets. Mm-hmm. And you get reports of, of kind of two things. Some Indigenous people avidly seeking out rum for a variety of reasons because they don't drink in the same way. They don't drink more than Europeans, but they drink in a different way. They tend to, according to the reports that we get from the sources, they tend to value almost as a kind of spiritual experience, the experience of getting very drunk. It wasn't a matter of, you know, sipping on a drink. It was to experience that altered mental state. Which let down all kinds of inhibitions and then often led to quite dreadful results. So you get that. You get other Indigenous people, or maybe the same people at different moments, doing their best to eliminate the presence of alcohol and telling traders they're not welcome and making efforts to stop this. But, you know, as we know, these things are very hard to control.
Yeah, but absolutely.
So it just becomes way, way more prevalent. The rise of the Northwest Company is mostly fueled by cheap rum. They even start their own distilleries in Quebec City and Montreal.
Oh wow!
And they go all in.
There was something you wrote where the Hudson's Bay Company was a little more hesitant to utilize rum in their transactions than the Northwest Company. Is that accurate?
Yeah, for sure. The Hudson's Bay Company always ran a much more tightly disciplined operation, they did use alcohol as an enticement, mostly brandy, actually. Until they ended up competing head to head with the Northwest Company, and then they needed cheap rum as well. They called them the Canadian traders. They considered them totally unscrupulous,
right?
Which probably fair enough.
Yep.
So the Hudson's Bay Company is generally a bit more is quite a bit more restrained than the Northwest Company, which just very aggressive, hook and by crook, whatever it takes.
It's interesting what you just had said too before, in that there are examples of Indigenous leaders or communities actually saying, you're not welcome here if you bring rum with you. I find that element of agency kind of interesting. Could you elaborate on that at all?
I don't have the notes right in front of me here, but I mean, yeah, there are several occasions where they try to get British imperial authorities, military authorities to intervene. They use violence themselves or the threat of it to get the rum traders out. But as I say, it's very hard for anyone to police. Certainly concerted efforts for sure.
And it's clear, it sounds to me that unlike under the French, where brandy is not as problematic as the church was probably making it out, it sounds like under the British, rum is becoming a problem and it's being recognized by a number of different groups and communities as a problem.
Well, it's being recognized by indigenous people as a problem, but it was in the 17th century that the French, especially the ecclesiastical authorities, are saying this is a problem, we got to do something about it. And then that dies away. And under the British regime, it's just like, they speak the language of business rationality and like, okay, that's how you do business. So it isn't actually in colonial circles, it's not as controversial as it had been in an earlier time under the French.
It's interesting because I guess that fits the model when we talk about, when we look at the Opium Wars or something like that, the British, they valued the concept of international trade and the movement of goods. I mean, that underpins the entire empire, doesn't it? This sort of hyper-capitalist, pushing commodities even into places that people don't want them, still pushing them nonetheless. So I think this fits with the colonial model that the British Empire imposed upon much of the globe that it was in control of.
It's not entirely just the British, it's also the period. So the 17th century is a, there's more, I suppose, moralistic and religious concerns in the 17th century. Even in New England there is. But as time passes into the 18th century, well, listen, empires are about commerce and about profits and
Wherever the empire goes, so does business, right? Like you said, I mean, I think the best metaphor is the fact that right after the conquest of Quebec, right after the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, we're talking about ships of New England rum coming in right away. So on the heels of conquest is, commodities, right? Very much so. One of the interesting elements you discuss a little bit is the relationship between labor issues in what would become Canada and the rum industry. So what is that connection?
So we were just talking about, say, the Northwest Company flogging rum to indigenous hunters, but they're also flogging it to their own employees. So in this period, say 18th to early 19th century, drinking on the job is not only tolerated, it's almost mandatory. So the French Canadian voyageurs who are paddling the canoes loaded with these barrels of rum are encouraged to have a nip whenever they please, and it's charged to their salary account at a grossly inflated price. So it's crucial to the personnel relations of the Northwest. If the Northwest Company actually paid all the salaries that by contract were due to their own employees, they would have gone broke. So they arrange it so that everybody gets access to the rum barrel, and the bourgeois in charge keeps tabs in his accounts. And the ones who are particularly going into the far northwest, I've seen several sort of account books of for salaries due, and almost every single voyageur comes to the end of their 3-year contract owing the company more than the company owes them. So their net salary is zero or minus whatever. So this is great in a number of ways. First of all, the company doesn't have to pay their employees. As I say, they couldn't have afforded to if they had. And second, it helps with recruitment, because after somebody's finished their 3-year contract, they say, well, you better sign on for another contract because you owe us. X number of
Wow.
pounds. So it functions to minimize expenditure for salaries, and it also helps to recruit and retain the labor force. And I think rum has everything to do with that.
Yeah, that's a pretty tricky way to keep people connected to the company. Was there ever a rum industry that developed in any significant way in the Canadas?
Yeah. So Halifax has a distillery as of, I think, 1754. I haven't talked about the cod fisheries and the Maritimes.
Yeah, that's right.
Element of the story. So Halifax has a couple of substantial distilleries early on as local entrepreneurs realize that a lot of money is to be made in this industry, and they can, undermine the imports from further south. There's a distillery set up in Quebec City in 1767. It kind of doesn't work out very well. And then there's by the 1780s, there's three in Quebec and one in Montreal.
Oh, wow.
But there were distilleries, yes. And in fact, the one in Montreal seemed to have been intimately connected with the networks of merchants that formed the Northwest Company. So it's kind of
interesting.
Of the Northwest Company, although they sell rum locally as well, and they have a ship that just goes down to the Caribbean to pick up molasses and comes back, and so it's a fairly substantial operation. But I think it's probably still just a fraction of the covers only a fraction of the
right.
colonial consumption.
By the beginning of the 19th century, then rum. I mean, alcohol in general, but rum is clearly playing a fairly prominent role in, let's say, the common person in the Canadas, in the Maritimes. It seems to have become part of the sort of cultural day-to-day of a lot of lives, from those in what would become Quebec to the East Coast to what would become Ontario, et cetera, and like you said, Newfoundland. Is there a reason why, besides, because you give that example of the voyageurs and the Northwest Company using rum to sort of gain credit back from and avoid having to pay full salaries. Is there a different reason or a similar reason why rum then becomes prominent in the staple trades, as you call them?
Yeah, because it's, we just established that very much in the fur trade, both as far as Indigenous people and French Canadian voyageurs are concerned, It's the same story in the Atlantic cod fishery, even earlier, where again it's a question of, in the absence of slavery, when you've got a supposedly free labor market, in a colonial setting, labor is expensive. There aren't that many people available,
right.
And the people there can often just go to work on their own farms or whatever. So how do you recruit labor? You have to pay top dollar. So it's a device for kind of offering high wages and then clawing them back.
Right.
It's also a device for recruitment. So in Newfoundland, it's a matter of how do the settler fishermen who want to hire a crew, how do they recruit from the guys who are coming over on the ships from England and Ireland? Is they get people hooked on rum, and then they owe them, and they say, well, I'll give you a job, you can work it off.
Wow.
And you can keep drinking while you're at it. And it was, given that we're talking about people working out in the sea and in cold, damp climates, it was they could pretend that this was, a health benefit.
Yeah.
You have your first drink before breakfast, routinely, and you have a few nips during the day. And so next thing, you've got your workforce kind of addicted, and you're docking their pay
right
accordingly, and then you retain them by by the time they come to the end of their contract, they
right.
owe you,
right?
And that's very routine in both the fishery and the fur trade. I think.
How long does rum dominate the consumption of spirits in the Canadas? When does it start fading out, or at least start being matched by other spirits?
Yeah. So two things develop. One is the rise of whiskey. So Upper Canada, you know, very much hooked into sort of the Midwestern U.S. pattern, starts on a small scale whiskey distilleries as a way of kind of dealing with grain surpluses. If you can't get your before railroads, you can't get your grain to market. One thing you can do if you've got a surplus is distill it into whiskey, and that lasts, and it can be sold, and so on. So in Upper Canada, in the early 19th century, they start, you know, getting a lot of small scale local whiskey distilleries that replace rum. So that's one of the things that happens to rum. The Maritimes and Quebec still have a taste more for rum and still to some extent brandy. But the western part of the Canada is go over to whiskey. So that's one of the things that happens is replacement with whiskey. The other thing that happens is the rise of the temperance movement.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, you know, about the 1820s, more so the 1830s, there's a kind of moral and religious reaction to the prevalence of drunkenness. There's just a lot of alcohol and a lot of, you know, a lot of fighting and spousal abuse and all kinds of social problems that some people attribute to alcohol. So it's only at that time that alcohol gets to be viewed as a bad and dangerous thing.
Right.
You know, prior to that, it was considered to have medicinal properties, and it was only the overuse that was condemned. And you start getting people in the 1830s saying alcohol is bad. You just should not drink at all.
Right.
And it's an effective campaign, and it truly does reduce the consumption. You know, long before there's prohibition, there's a kind of moral campaigns that do greatly reduce the consumption of alcohol.
It's kind of interesting. It's almost like full circle. You know, 17th century, there's a French moralizing element, church-led. 18th century, you know, it's kind of every person for themselves. And then the 19th century, this moralizing element returns in the form of different churches, but same kind of conversations.
Yeah. And it's same but different in that no one ever suggested actual prohibition in the 17th century. It was just, you know, calm it down and don't give it to Indigenous people was the message. But by the 1830s, there are people saying, you know, it's all bad and evil. And it's interesting that this is a time when, you know, the economy and the society are changing in that we're no longer just talking about labor in, you know, remote places and extractive industries. We're getting the beginnings of industrial capitalism, where you want laborers who are regular and reliable in their behavior.
And for the final question, when looking at the history of rum in the Canadas, in British North and French, and then British North America, and then what would become Canada, what does the story of rum tell us about the development of early Canada?
I think it tells us a lot about how colonialism deployed and manipulated labor to create profitable enterprises. You know, it's one solution to the problem of labor in overseas places. So that I think is worth underlining. It's also an illustration of global connections that are at play in Canada. You know, this is not just a local story. This is a story that is necessarily making connections with transatlantic and even global kinds of circulation of goods and ideas. And it specifically connects sugar plantation complex of the West Indies. And something that I think, as you mentioned earlier, tends to be overlooked and shouldn't be ignored.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find us on all your podcast listening devices. You can also find us on Acast, on Patreon, as well as on Instagram and Facebook just by searching Curious Canadian History. And folks, please do not hesitate to leave a rating and a comment wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.